This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Well, we've learned so much already, and this is, it's just so exciting for me to see this unfold and for you all to be here to partake with us. A thank you to the Department of Religious Studies and Chair Juan Campo for sponsoring lunch. So thank you for that. We all ate well. We're going to turn now to a panel this afternoon that features a number of students trained by Walter Capps and explore the different ways they've embraced and extended his legacy. So I'm very much looking forward to this for selfish reasons. They're all colleagues I've learned so much from over the years, and it's just bound to be great. Introducing them and moderating the panel will be Juan Campo, the chair of the Department of Religious Studies, and we're grateful that he's our chair. He's leading us forward in a good time. We have exciting things to look forward to. So thank you for taking up this role today, Professor Campo. So thank you, welcome.
Well, I'm truly humbled to be here today, first in terms of the celebration of Walter Capps' life, who was so much a part of my career here at UCSB, and also to be here in the presence of his family, Lois and Laura, friends from the community. Todd. I know the ladies of the family more than you guys. So, and also, of course, seeing our fantastic student alumni, our colleagues from religious studies and members of the community. It's so such an honor to be here before you and to be here on this occasion to celebrate Walter's life and career. As a welcome, I would like to say that we need to acknowledge that UCSB is located on indigenous land. In recognizing the traditional customs of the land, we pay respect for the Chumash people, the history and culture of the community, and all Native Americans as America's first peoples. We pay respect to the Chumash elders, past, present, and future, for they hold the memories, the traditions, and the culture of this area, which has become a place of learning for people from all over the world. Next year, our department celebrates its 60th year. It's gonna be our 60th anniversary. And I've been here 40 of those years. there are a few of us that have been here longer than that. So, it's really, we want to mark that occasion, but I think this is a good way to sort of get us oriented to the 60th anniversary. Let me tell you a little bit about our origin myth. I think religious studies, we oftentimes orient ourselves to how things began and how different cultures and different religious traditions, you know, think about their origins. Our origins, interestingly, as religious studies, unlike much of the country, we don't come out of theology or theology school or something like that. We kind of come out of political science. The first person to talk about teaching anything religious at the University of California at Santa Barbara was in the political science department, and that was D. Mackenzie Brown back in the 1950s. So he is successful in getting a course in political science called Religious Institutions. I guess that was safe enough in those days. You know, at a modern state university, getting all these baby boomers in and things. And so it came about in 1958 was this course. 1963, you had the Abington School District versus Shemp decision in the Supreme Court, which allowed the teaching about religion in public schools. And I think that definitely, you know, was made an impression in terms of making religious studies an important part of a curriculum in a public university like the University of California. So 1964 is the date for the actual establishment of our department. And it had two young professors to sort of get it going. I can't imagine a department starting today with only two people. Our executive vice chancellor, David Marshall, is here. Maybe you can tell me there are some departments that try to do that. But you know, this I think was great that we were able to start a department with two, with Walter Capps as one of them, and W. Richard Comstock, Dick Comstock, as the others. So that was two faculty in 1964. By 1983, when I first joined, we had 10. So multiplied fivefold, right, in that time period. So that's a sign of success. in addition to the students that were taking our courses and the graduates that we produced during that time period. Now we have, by my count, 21 tenured professors, 6 lecturers, and at least 2 professorships on the way. Fingers crossed. So we continue to grow, and we greatly appreciate the support our university has given us in making this possible, as well as the community and our students. You know, we wouldn't be able to have growth in our department in these days when the budgets are so tight without having a track record that we can build on and demonstrate our importance and relevance to higher education in a public university system. True to the vision of its founding members, our department encompasses multiple methods, recognizes religious phenomena on a scale from local to the global, and engages with an inclusive array of peoples and cultures, past and present. We should recognize that UCSB's Department of Religious Studies was founded not only at a time of growth for public universities in the country, but also at a time of tremendous social change and turbulence, the 1960s, with the onset of the Vietnam War, the anti-war movements, the burning of Bank of America in Isla Vista, assassinations of JFK, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, and Robert Kennedy, the urban riots that spread through the countries from Harlem, Rochester, Philadelphia, Watts, Chicago. It was also a time for the civil rights movements and the women's movement, all in the 1960s, a tremendous time of change and turbulence in American society, as well as conflict. So it's in this context that Walter recognized that religion was a field of studies that belongs in the university, encompassing both the humanities and social sciences. This outlook is epitomized in his 1972 book, The Ways of Understanding Religion. I have a dog-eared copy of that, much annotated, that I got my first year of graduate school at the University of Chicago. We asked Jonathan Z. Smith, our mentor there when we started out, what he'd recommend for us to read in terms of a selection of different writings about study and methods and theories in religion. And that's the book he recommended by Walter Capps, a former colleague of Jonathan Z's back in the late 1960s. You know, Jonathan Z. Smith was actually here at that time. And I think that relationship remained close through the years, even though they had very divergent personalities and specializations. This book, The Ways of Understanding Religion, is kind of a predecessor over a decade or more than a decade of his of another major book, which is his Religious Studies: The Making of a Discipline. In this book, he refers to religious studies as a field, and then in the second book, he tries to really define what religious studies is as a discipline, based after a number of years of thinking about it and seeing how religious studies was growing in the country. But we, in addition to this theoretical, methodological, strand of Walter's career, we must also recognize that his vision extended beyond religion as a subject for rational inquiry and explanation to encompass religion as a meaningful ethical agent that shaped people's lives and enhanced the common good and civic values. So this involved a public-facing orientation, not an ivory tower, orientation to scholarship, but a public-facing orientation for scholarship and religious studies. And that's something that he increasingly embodied in the latter stages of his career. As a teacher through courses like The Impact of the Vietnam War, which we'll have more about in another session, and his course on the Voices of the Stranger. I think, again, these are first public-facing topics and things that really try to make a contribution to the common good. So he, in the public sphere, he's also, as we learned from this morning, the public advocate of the humanities, and the public-facing component of his career then leads to his contributions and leadership as a congressional candidate and as an actual member of the House of Representatives, and I think very valued and cherished by his fellow representatives, even after a very short period of time in the House, he made a tremendous impression. So this public-facing aspect of Walter's life lives on very much in the Capps Center today in an area, in an era that is just as turbulent, if not more so, than the 1960s, making the vision that Walter had even more important for us to try to realize through the CAP Center and hopefully through the activities of not only members of the CAP Center, but also members of the Religious Studies faculty at UCSB. We want to have more of a public-facing component for that and revitalize that aspect of our community and our religious studies culture. So Walter's optimistic vision coming out of the 1960s is needed now more than ever. So with that, I'd like to introduce our first two presenters. I think we'll get a good overview and much more in-depth on the subject of Walter's contribution to the study of religion with our presenters this afternoon. And we begin with Edward Linenthal and Wendy Wright. And let me tell you a little bit about each of these presenters. Edward is kind of awkward. Sorry, Ed. There he is. Is a professor emeritus of history at Indiana University. He served as editor for the Journal of American History from 2005 to 2016. He served as a visiting scholar for the National Park Service, and for almost a decade was a member of the Flight 93 Memorial Commission. That's after the 9/11 attacks and the way those events are memorialized. For several years, he co-directed the Gilder Lehman's Institute of America's History Summer Teacher Seminar, 9/11 American Memory at the National September 11th Memorial and Museum in New York, and he's the author and editor of 7 books, and they're amazing books, but they're books that address, you know, vital issues in terms of how memorial sites of tragedy and violence are memorialized and remembered, and going from the Oklahoma City bombing to Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., and actual visits to Holocaust sites in Europe, and then also looking at the bombing of the Oklahoma City bombing, and also the 9/11 attacks, and a number of other contexts, Civil War battlefields. I mean, it could go on and on, but it's amazing, his scholarship, and the ways in which that contributes, I think, to greater public understanding of the issues involved with these sites. So in addition to Ed, then, this section of our panel, we have Wendy Wright, professor emerita of theology at Creighton University and presently an affiliate faculty of the Oblate School of Theology's Institute for the Study of Contemporary Spirituality. She earned her PhD in religious studies at UCSB in 1983, so as I came in, she was leaving. And her areas of expertise include the history of Christian spiritualities and the Catholic devotional traditions. She is the author of 17 books and over 60 academic articles, and a longtime spiritual director working presently with a novitiate team of the Franciscans in California's Central Coast. So we'll have their two presentations, and then we'll take a short break after that. The other three panelists, I'll introduce them, and then for Q&A, we'll do that at the very end. So please keep your questions and answers, if you have any, for the first two panelists in mind. You might want to jot a note. There's some note paper over here, I noticed. So Ed, do you want to start? Sure. Please come up.
Thank you, everyone. Before I turn to the subject at hand, I have a program note at the end of the sessions tomorrow. Todd Capps and I have adopted some of Walter's jokes to a modern dance. And there are levels of creativity that the two of us have that haven't been plumbed, right, at all. And we're thoughtful, and so we know that you're going to want to sort of relive the presentation. So we'll have CDs for sale there. I don't want to be too forward, but these are really stocking stuffers for the whole family. Yeah, and if you're wondering why IU ever let me loose in the classroom, this is a question that's been asked for years now. Okay, so Ulla and I left Santa Barbara in 1979 to move back to Wisconsin, and I was fortunate. Walter invited me back a number of times to do presentation in the Vietnam class and for his de Tocqueville seminar to talk about struggles to memorialize violent events. And after one visit, after his unsuccessful bid in 1994, we were in his study at the Hermitage, and he told me that he was at work on a book about religion and politics seen through the prism of running for office. And after successful campaign in 96, I recall thinking this book could be delayed for a while. So when I received an invitation to participate in a kind of first take of the stuff that we're doing this weekend, Richard Hecht and I think Clark Roof organized this conference exploring the legacy of Walter Capp's contribution to religious studies in 2008, and a number of us who are speaking today were participating in that panel. I was really excited, and I wanted the opportunity to go through some of Walter's stuff, materials, to know about his thinking about why he ran for office and what he expected. Because it seemed to me there was a quite different set of challenges that Walter would face. I mean, would his voice be distinct among the cacophony of voices in Washington? Would he be perceived as little more than an exotic oddity, the professor who became congressman? Would he be framed and contained from the beginning? How did his vocation as scholar and teacher prepare him, if it did, for this challenge? So I called Congresswoman Lois Capps, Lois, and asked her if there was stuff. And she said, yes, indeed, there is stuff, and it's all here, and it's uncatalogued, and you're more than welcome to come some days before the seminar and go through what you can. So I spent, I don't know, 3 or 4 days, Lois, sort of feverishly going through stuff to try and put together a presentation for the 2008 program. And I titled it Professor Capps Goes to Congress. Yes. And I want to revisit that today because I'm sure most all of you have not been browsing through the stuff, which I'm now very glad to know is in the library at Santa Barbara. So there is, as you can imagine, a treasure trove of materials, proposals for books, God in the Oval Office, Political Religion in the Reagan Era, and then he retitled that, I'm not sure when, Chief Pastor, Religion and the American Presidency, that extends a focus beyond Reagan. There are numerous videotapes, and I know we're gonna see some of this from campaigns. There are drawers filled, with correspondence with many, many, many people. There are drafts of op-eds for the LA Times. There are autopsies of the 1994 campaign. I found Walter's justification, which I had always wondered about, for the seminars on de Tocqueville, and this is what he wrote for the National Endowment of Humanities. The text is Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America, and the subject is the status and function of religion within a democratic society. Reflecting on a 1986 seminar, Walter wrote that participants, his voice, recreated an extended and ongoing conversation, very much like the inquiry that is reflected in de Tocqueville's book. It was a conversation about what it means to be an American, what democracy asks of religion, and religion of democracy, how the freedoms Americans enjoy are both sustained and thwarted, and the place and protections of individual initiative within a democratic collective order. There is a Walter Capps manifesto written for staff members as the campaign was being organized in fall of 1995. The categories are really interesting, and there were some documents, of course, in each of these. The larger global setting was one. National and domestic issues. The moral and spiritual temper of our times. Restoring a bond of political trust. The environment and individual and collective well-being. affirmative action, gender issues, and the status of so-called other people, the primacy of education, attitudes toward representative government, and Walter Capp's personal ambition. It's a fascinating document. Throughout, we hear clear, concise statements of conviction. Walter Capp urges mindfulness of the larger global framework and cautions that the United States is currently experiencing a dangerous isolationist tendency, reflected in intense criticism of the United Nations. Walter Capp believes that the United States must exercise its global responsibilities in a cooperative, mutually supportive manner. Walter Capp attests that life does not flow from ideology and that American imperialism is not the answer to the world's needs. And in a short essay written in 1984, The Vietnam War and Cultural Memory, Walter informed readers, "I became interested in studying the impact of the Vietnam War in 1977. And we've heard about some of the dramatic moments earlier today. He writes, "When I was given some responsibility for programming within the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions, programs about Vietnam and the impact of the Vietnam War about liberal ideology, he was moved, as we've heard, about the power of veteran stories. I remember participating in a 1978 Center conference, The Vietnam War and American Values, at which Walter offered a paper for discussion, The War's Transformation. And you can find this in the Center magazine, July and August 1978. And it seemed to me that from this moment on, Walter's attention turned not only to the complex legacies of the Vietnam War, but what he, of course, and many others saw as enduring deformations in American public culture. Well before the boom in memory studies, in memory, many fields, came Walter's book, The Unfinished War. In both the Vietnam and Voices of the Stranger courses, Walter was willing to live with and ask his students to live with the intellectually and emotionally draining realization that there are certain chronic afflictions that do not allow closure or redemptive endings. Yet he was steadfast in his belief that, in his words, veterans who are leading the way are pointing to some deeply abiding human truths that are encountered in regions lying far beyond worlds made accessible by a political dialectics. He understood the power of the witness, at that point an emerging sacred figure in the culture, who returned from extreme situations or conditions to offer testimony, contemporary sacred narratives. I thought often of Walter's characterization of the war as unfinished, particularly as I was immersed in my work in Oklahoma City about the impact of a terrorist attack upon an American city and the predicament of aftermath that occurs in events like these. I thought about his book as I chose the title of my book in Oklahoma City, The Unfinished Bombing, Oklahoma City in American Memory. Too often, strategies are deployed that transform those impacted by violence into patients rather than witnesses, and insist that their stories be framed as illness narratives rather than impassioned testimony, the crucial language of moral witness. Walter modeled for me and others how our professional journeys could take us beyond the academy, and he was not alone in the religious studies department. One of the first challenges I recall was offered by Richard Hecht, who I wish could be here, in a 1979 essay called Religious Studies After the Holocaust. And Richard wrote, no academic discipline within the modern university can shield itself from the impact of history and historical events. Attempts to clearly separate what is done within the university context and what occurs in history are short-lived. all disciplines within the university are conditioned by history. This simple fact, he writes, is even more powerful within those disciplines which self-consciously define themselves as having something to say to the historical understanding of man and to the human predicament at the end of the 20th century. Richard concludes, we have not yet realized that historical events of our century have doomed our enterprise to antiquarian studies or have made what we are doing even more vital. Walter followed in 1981 with a challenging essay titled Contemporary Socio-Political Change and the Work of Religious Studies. Why, he asks, have we not developed a mode of critical cultural consciousness which utilizes religion as its primary means of access? And when we have learned to do this, why do we restrict our focus of inquiry to the world of the past tense? Why are we not able to say more about the dynamics of contemporary cultural change? In that same piece, Walter branded into my mind what felt like a declaration of intellectual independence for the kind of work that I wanted to do. He writes, my feeling is, and I'm being self-critical, that we are still writing term papers to each other rather than thinking through the strategy by which religious studies might more regularly and substantially contribute to the welfare of our larger collective life. And is it any wonder that many of us would have turned to these kinds of challenges in our work to want to make a difference in the wider public? I never really cared about, frankly, writing books for my colleagues. I talked to them all the time. They were busy with their own work. When I wrote, always I had in mind a next-door neighbor who was not an academic but was a thinking person. I wanted to write a book for them, and I avoided at all costs the kind of methodological heavy breathing that goes on in religious studies. I don't know if any of you remember what Walter would say when someone asked him if he had a methodology. I've gotten into a lot of trouble using Walter's term. He said, well, I had one, but it was shot off in the war. So. Okay. Yeah, probably not the best time to take up a collection, is it? So let me conclude with a focus on Walter's early thoughts about the book manuscript that I mentioned, and I haven't done anything since this time at the Caps home, so maybe people have found more chapters. It would be wonderful if they did. And it felt to me like Walter was writing sort of these thoughts to himself, that it was like a pre-first draft thinking. The introduction was called On Running for Congress, and it's an extended commentary on the meaning and message of the 1994 election. Interesting. It does not stand, he writes, as the event which marks a decision by the citizenry to chart a new path. Rather, it symbolizes an explosion of collective emotion against prevailing government, no longer trusted or respected, and at times, hardly even recognized. Right, the vision of dark clouds, right, already there, now just on steroids. Chapter one, a candidate's perspective. Walter writes about his many activities that took him to Washington over many years, and he came to recognize, he reflects, much of our aspiration as a people cannot approximate full fruition unless it is validated by the legislative process. He first gave serious consideration to running after working with Senator Bob Kerrey's campaign for president in 1992. Then came deep struggle. I was forewarned that running for office is an identity-defining experience. Perhaps nothing you have ever encountered, he was told, will define you as deeply and as surely. Walter visited the offices of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee and emerged quite discouraged. After all, he writes, what did I know about crime, the economy, immigration, and Governor Wilson? What I did know, and knew rather well, was how to create and teach college and university classes, stimulate intellectual interest in a topic, conduct research, and of course, think about beliefs and attitudes, individual aspirations, the spirit of our times, the desires of people all over the earth to live together in peace, the longings among the less fortunate for a life of realistic promise, and the desire of young people for an opportunity to live their ideals in a world that is given formation by hope rather than fear, and generosity rather than anger. A world that is given formation by hope rather than fear, and generosity rather than anger. Why then did he run? The reason has more to do, he reflects, with seeing it as an expansion of vocation, believing that I had something to contribute, rather than the fulfillment of a life's ambition. It is no small thing, he cautions, to seek elected office. To be a representative of the people is to seek entry into important protected places of their lives, to ask them to attach their dreams and aspirations, and yes, their indignations, to the candidate's instrumentational abilities. And a very brief Walter story. We have to have at least one. We really should have many more, but time is necessary. So, and Walter tells us one on himself. He recalls the burden of the oft-asked question, how do we know you are not another Bill Clinton? And Walter said, we tried for a bit of humor some of the time. I'm not Bill Clinton. I play the tuba. And then he writes, but the humorous response did not suffice. The last chapter I read, and I have no idea if Walter saw this as the final chapter, is titled Politics and Spirituality. The first section is entitled Politics as Pilgrimage. I am suggesting, he writes, that the run for political office is like pilgrimage in a number of ways. It is directed movement. It requires total involvement. The movement and involvement create a strong sense of community in that one is accompanied on the journey by persons who are dedicated to the same cause and or to sustain the pilgrim. And the bonding is as strong as anything the participants had previously experienced. This is why, writes, campaign activists, when talking about their experiences, tend to highlight one campaign that was extraordinary for them. Wherever it happened, whatever the political season, this was the normative pilgrimage, the one in which values and stamina were tested, and the recollection of who actually got the most vote sometimes occurs as an afterthought. To realize that the race is over is to sense that life can begin to return to some sense of normalcy. It's why those who devised the liturgical year made provision for the exciting, uplifting, exhilarating high holy days, to be followed by days when the human spirit could somehow take refuge in what is most appropriately called ordinary time. The degree of soul searching that belongs to politics, particularly in the heat of the campaign, is not unlike that which is fostered in religion. The difference is that religion provides a standard or some authorized vectors in relation to which the search is conducted, while the vectors that are most promising in politics are the numbers that tell one how it appears that one is doing relative to how one's opponent is doing. Walter's, and I gathered from conversations that this was fairly well known, his dislike for fundraising is evident in the next section, politics as mendicant experience. In traditional religious terms, he writes, a mendicant is a person who renounces the ownership of personal property and sometimes in very austere fashion relies on the goodwill and the charity of others. The politician, by comparison and contrast, asks for money from virtually everyone with whom he or she comes in contact. The support a monk seeks, however, is affirmation of the way he or she trusts the way the universe is ordered. That is, they live by grace, the support of others, and the bounty of whoever rules this earth. In politics, the same transaction have become so completely tarnished that they become bane rather than blessing, impediment rather than facilitator. The final sections of this chapter are progressive politics and progressive spirituality, contrasting the world of politics and academics, and the teaching of Jesus. It is a topic, Walter writes, whose force has been growing in my reflections and which I suspect is more central to the subject of this chapter than I can fully appreciate. It was on a trip to Jerusalem, he remembers, a life-affecting trip, when a completely unexpected fusion took place. It was a fusion regarding the relationship between politics and the religious life, in a word. It was while we were there that I became aware of the political dimensions of the ministry of Jesus. It is about how Jesus of Nazareth lived his life and spent his time traveling from town to town to talk with assembled groups about what was happening in their lives, in both individual and collective sense, and to offer words of encouragement. There are similarities, he writes, between this form of ministry and running for office. How did anyone know Jesus would be coming? On what basis did he choose his topics? Did he give the same talk several times? Were his audiences mostly pliant, or did some give him a difficult time? How did he make his voice heard? Did he ever tire of the daily grind? How dependent was he upon his advisors? The only sin he always condemned, Walter notes, was that of self-righteousness. He was a man of compassion who recognized children, gave validation to people of other races and cultures, and when the choice had to be made, put human factors above prescribed cultic practice or established legal obligation. The ultimate vision, shared by other persons of great compassion, Walter writes, is that the world is unitary, and that our politics and our spirituality cannot forever be bifurcated, but they are rather ingredients in the same whole. My own view, he writes, is that reciprocity needs to rule, namely that spiritual vitality enjoins political culture, and political culture is complemented by recognition of the place and the power of the transcendent. So, my formal comments. And before, I know I'm probably a little bit over time, but since we probably won't be doing this again, at least with the same audience, I want just to say a couple of personal notes here. Whenever we were invited to the CAPS home, it was like the highlight of the day, week, month, year. When Walter and Lois went away, we stayed with the kids once, and went, of course, to McConnell's, and had a wonderful time. Walter and Lois had a gorgeous male golden retriever named Chester, and we took care of Chester, or Chester took care of us, I'm not sure which. And we were blessed then for almost 40 years with golden retrievers. And the last one was a big, big male, just like Chester. And his name was Chester Austin Linenthal. We thought about the Capps family all the time with our Goldens. The night that my mother died, very sadly, very early, in really quite a horrible situation, Ul and I went over to the Capps's that night. And I don't think we talked a whole lot. We were just sort of there. And those of you who've been there know that that's really enough, that the place massaged you with kindness and with understanding and with love. And it has always been and continues to be that way. So, final thing that I'll mention, not the final one I could mention, but 1980, Phoebe told, 1982, whatever it was, I got a call in Wisconsin, not 1982, 2002, sorry, asking if I would offer the Capps lecture for the Humanities Council. Of course, my first word was, yes, absolutely, with a big exclamation mark at the end of that. My second sentence was, is Lois going to be there? And she was in Minneapolis, sitting in the front row, so I tried to be on my best behavior, but who knows. But to be a student of Walter's and then to sort of thank him for what he did to me in all kinds of ways by doing a lecture in his name with Lois there was, everyone should have those kind of moments in their life. So thank you very much.
Well, can you hear me okay? Yeah, thank you. It's a little overwhelming to speak after those beautiful sentiments of Ed's and the extraordinary energy of the Humanities Council people today. Ed's wonderful seminar yesterday, but here I am, and this is an okay thing. When I was asked to participate in this and to think about Walter Capps and the study of religion, I decided not to talk about my ongoing work, but rather to talk about what it meant to learn alongside Walter. And this is pre-Vietnam class, pre the expanded work with the humanities, pre his foray into politics. So this was, I studied with him from 1974, finally got my doctorate in 1983. But it was, my experience of Walt was, all of this was sort of in the background and budding, but my experience of him was quite different. And what I'd like to share with you was what it was like to learn alongside him, because he was not just a teacher, he was a fellow learner. And I learned a lot about myself and about what it means to encounter religious experience and also what it means to pass that on to other people. I've entitled this talk, The Mystic Mode, and I think that needs to be a little bit of an explanation for it. As I said, I studied with Walter from 1974, finally graduating in 1983, but over the years we kept in frequent touch. In fact, just months before his death, when he was serving at the United States House of Representatives, he and Lois traveled to Omaha, Nebraska, to deliver an address entitled From Campus to Congress, The Journey of a Peacemaker, at Creighton University, where my husband and I were teaching at the time. And as I've suggested, many of you will speak much more elaborately and eloquently about the multiple facets of his scholarly work and how that continues today. But again, I want to focus what it was like to learn in his company. Not just what was learned, but how learning took place. During the decade of my studies, Walt's ever-inquiring mind had grown fascinated with the contemplative or mystical writings of the Western Christian tradition. Fortuitously, that mirrored my own budding fascination. As a result, he and I explored that field together. I TA'd for him. We developed a course called The Monastic Impulse. And eventually, we edited a book together entitled Silent Fire, An Invitation to Western Mysticism, which was published by Harper and Row in 78. This is almost like a museum relic at this point or something, an artifact. The Mystic Mode was the title of the forewording essay that Walt wrote for our volume. My contribution to the publication was the journeyman's labor of editing selections and writing introductory paragraphs for each of those representative Christian spiritual masters. But Walt's part was more conceptual. He probed what he came to describe as the mystic mode, which he said, and this is an important point here, did not denote something esoteric, but rather a fundamental way of being human and of relating to the world. I'll underscore that again. A fundamental way of being human and of relating to the world. Walt's probing of this mode, especially during the 70s, I would contend, helps to illuminate his fundamental approach to learning, which in turn illuminated and animated his teaching, his scholarship, his love of the humanities, and public service. Now, a caveat here. I'm not claiming Walt as some sort of ill-defined mystic or something, nor am I suggesting that his toe-dipping into the theoretical waters on the study of mysticism was complete or prescient. Huge amounts of literature have been developed since this time. But I do think that Walt's exploration gives access to his approach to learning. And this is the way he expanded about the mystic mode. Distinct from a host of other ways of being human, the mystic way does not approach the world as though it was a problem to be solved. Nor does it view it as a puzzle to be pieced together, or even an entity that can be penetrated by a formula or idea. The mystic way exposes reality as a mystery, deep but trustworthy, a very large portion of which will always remain unknown, uncharted, and resistant to human program. So what does this say about learning and studying in religion? I have an indelible image etched on my memory of the first class I took from Professor Capps. He was lecturing on the fourth century classic, The Confessions of St. Augustine of Hippo, and he scrawled two terms in big, bold capital letters on the blackboard, superbia and humilitas. Of all the approaches that can be taken to that classic text, you can do literary analysis, philosophical, historical, theological, on and on. The central vivid point our professor wanted to drive home was Augustine's interior transition, his shift from the posture that would later define his life. Most of you know this, but Augustine had, for most of his youth, taken and used things for self-promoting ends. He'd striven energetically in Platonic ascent to the heights of spiritual attainment, superbia, agency, pride. That was Augustine's mode. His conversion was to the attitude of humilitas, a receptive, awed, graced, grateful stance focused away from self-promotion to attention to something other than the self. This early introduction taught me not only about a great Christian classic, but suggested that the study of religion is at least in part about what it means to orient the self. Religion delves into such questions about what it means to be fully human and how one orients to reality. Over the years, I would come to feel that Walt's own way of being and learning was just such a posture. And people have said this in different ways during this talk about he'd come into a room and he would glow and people, you know, just his wonderful humor and all that sort of thing. But it was an interior orientation that was receptive, open to surprise, discovery, constantly probing, refusing to capture, eager always to dig deeper into the dimensions of whatever can give rise to human flourishing. This, I think, was much more than just avid curiosity or an exercise in the teaching on the many-sidedness of truth. It was Walt's way. It's true that Walt's scholarly approach to the discipline of religion was serious. It was serious, but it was rarely solemn. His approach was also joyful, playful, sometimes mischievous. Tooling around the city in the little red VW bug, hosting grad parties in the living room of 1724 Santa Barbara Street, the address, easily recalled, he would say, as it was the same as Immanuel Kant's birth year. Presiding over those gatherings at the keyboard of the piano, banging out the chords from the hymns of the Lutheran hymnal, and that's really important. The Lutheran hymnal is really important when you understand Walt. And if we were lucky, the giant tuba might emerge from its storage to accompany our singing. This playfulness carried over into his academic work. The way into the core of religious apprehension was, he knew, multidimensional and interdisciplinary, just as the discipline of religious studies implies. The way is through analysis, yes, but also through exploration of the full range of human endeavor, the sweep of hymnody, the beauty of art and architecture, the dense wisdom of poetry, the texture and shape of the inner longing of the heart. All the artifacts of our human search for meaning. Walt gave voice to this as he was writing his Mystic Mode essay. He said, "In the mystic way, reality is neither seized nor deciphered, nor can it be completely committed to an ideational formulation. Instead, it is engaged delicately, knowingly, and passionately. It is engaged by being loved. And being loved, it is also given an interior place." In this vein, Walt always stressed engagement. He certainly could employ any number of theoretical lenses to his study of human religiosity, but almost more than analytical tools, engagement was foremost. We've heard this already. He was all about field trips, immersions, direct experience. As his student, I perched with others on hard-backed chairs and spoke across an iron grill to the habited sisters in the cloister parlor of the Santa Barbara Poor Clares. And I sat at the feet of a young novice master at a Cistercian monastery in Oregon who unforgettably paraphrased poet Rainer Maria Rilke. To be a Christian is not about knowing the answers, but about living in the part of the self where the question is constantly being born. This emphasis on engagement, you know, has characterized Walt's approach to all his career. His Vietnam course, he ferried students to Washington, D.C. He traveled with veterans to the Soviet Union and to Vietnam. He brought voices of experience, voices of otherness into his classes. And later, he took a pilgrimage into the political landscape. All of these were potentially places of presence, places where insight and transformation might occur. As a student, this sort of engagement was formative. It set one down in a new landscape beyond thought, theory, and analysis into the part of the self where, as Rilke posited, the question was being born. A striking aspect of Walt as a mentor was knowing that he too was engaged in that same ongoing dynamic personal journey. In his edited volume, Thomas Merton, Preview of the Asian Journey, which transcribed and commented on the Cistercian monks' 1968 conversations at the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions here at UCSB, Capps wrote this. He, Merton, recognized the need to do more than study the texts, talk to expert witnesses, and write descriptive and interpretive essays. It was necessary for him to travel, to undertake a pilgrimage to Asia so that he could make his own observations within the natural habitat of Asian religious traditions. He wanted to travel because pilgrimage represented the next stage of development in his own spiritual path. I think it's not inappropriate to suggest that this sentiment can be applied to Walt as well. Engagement meant travel, but the engagement meant as well arrival at places of presence and the possibility of risking one's own spiritual religious assumptions, dipping into uncharted waters where reality, in all its daunting complexity, potentially exposes itself. To use Walt's words, reality exposes itself as a mystery, deep but trustworthy, a very large portion of which will always remain unknown, uncharted, and resistant to human probing. Learning for Walt involved awareness to what goes on within the self, yes, but equally it involved attentiveness to what was emerging on the cultural landscape. Steeped in the history and theology of the Christian past from his studies at Augustana Theological and at Yale, Walt sensed the future, was alert to the religious themes dawning on the contemporary horizon. This was certainly true when I entered the grad program at UCSB. At that time, actually, little was very much available in the English-speaking world of the variety and depth of the Western Christian spiritual practices, texts, and figures. Interest was just dawning. My generation had looked to the East, to D.T. Suzuki's Zen, Hermann Hesse's Siddhartha. But Walt and my professor-student foray into the Western wisdom sources appeared at the same time that it was also cresting culturally. It was at the same time that we published Sacred Fire, that the very first volume of what now is over 100 volume series of English translations and critical editions of Western spiritual classics appeared. So it was right on the crest of that. Likewise, his foray into mysticism, predated by several decades, the now definitive multi-volumed analysis of the Western mystical canon, entitled The Presence of God, authored by University of Chicago's Bernard McGinn. On the pastoral landscape, Walt's intuitions also mirrored the growing ecumenical awareness and appropriation spurred by the Roman Catholic Church's Second Vatican Council of the wealth of hidden Western spiritual treasures. Walt's attentiveness, and again, we've heard this throughout the presentations that have just begun, to whatever was dawning on the landscape was keen and continued. He was fascinated by psychoanalytic theory as it could be applied to religious figures like Luther and Gandhi. Then there was his groundbreaking exploration of the religious impact of the Vietnam War, his foregrounding the voices of stranger, his early sense that something was going on with the religious right, which I have to say at the time was not seen as all significant by anybody around him. They all went, oh, why are you bothering him with that? His fascination with Vaclav Havel, the political visionary steeped in the humanities, his foray into public service was a part of this unfolding journey toward a deepening encounter with the sacred and its transformational presence. Unitive and transformational, the mystic mode, as Walt understood it, was not confined to a particular religious tradition, nor to what is deemed formally instituted religion. Instead, he stressed that this mystic way was a fundamental way of being human and of relating to the world. And he has a wonderful paragraph in this essay that I think expresses the deep root of this awareness. And I think it also expresses deeply what was felt in Walt's presence. Life, he said, is a supreme gift for which the most appropriate posture is the giving of thanks. The mystics have caught sight of the truth that something, indeed being, is. When they take steps to monitor or influence the pulses of the interior life, it is because they have learned that the vitality that courses through their own spirits is of the same substance as that which issues from the heart of things. To acknowledge life as a supreme gift is to sense that the underlying mystery, unfathomable, ineffable, eventually unspeakable, is nevertheless benevolent. To receive it as mystery is to respect the beauty of its pathos. To learn alongside Walt Capps was to understand that grateful receptivity, passionate and playful engagement, attentiveness both to the contours of the self and to the emerging longings of the world with all its beauty and pathos. This was what the study and learning of religion was all about. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.